Let's move on and think about five steps to answer a tough question. That's our third topic for this afternoon. And as I said in my opening session an hour and a half ago, when I was at the hospital, my first job in the secular world, that fear of being asked a tough question was a big hindrance to me in evangelism. And I think it's a hindrance for many Christians. As I say, very, very common. I hear people say, well, I'd love to talk about my faith, you know, at work, at school, at whatever, but what if I'm asked a question? And so what I want to do in this session is actually teach you a simple set of steps that we can use to help us approach any tough question. And one of the challenges is that sometimes we can get into our heads, well, I need to memorize the answer to every conceivable tough question, and no human being can do that. And thus you can end up feeling a bit overloaded and a bit sort of daunted. But actually, so the steps I'm going to teach you in this session, and then say you can share those with others, feel free to share this material, help us with questions, even if we never heard those questions before. But before we come to that, it's worth reminding ourselves sometimes the church has a bit of a bad reputation when it comes to questions. A few years ago, I was chatting with a university student after an event. And this student told me, with a note of sadness in their voice, they said, well, Andy, I used to be a Christian, but I'm not any longer. And I always get sad. I'm always saddened when I hear that. But I asked them, I said, okay, sorry to hear that, but what happened? Can you tell me your story? And he replied, he said, yeah, well, what happened was I grew up in the church. And I grew up in a very fundamentalist, that was the word he chose, fundamentalist church. Where basically whatever the pastor said went, and you know, questions were not encouraged. You that was really not a thing you did. But he said, but despite that, I discovered in my teens a love for science. So when it came time to go to university, he said, I chose to come to the university that we were at, having the conversation. So I chose to come here and study biology. And he said, very quickly in the first term, I was being taught things in my lectures that clashed what I had been taught in church, especially around origins and the book of Genesis and so on. And he said, I began to really wrestle with that. So he said, I booked an appointment with my pastor to get his advice on that question. And I remember saying, I said, well, that was superb. Absolutely the right thing to do. And I said, did your pastor, you know, point you to some of the really many, many good resources written by Christians in the sciences, helping you think about those kind of questions? And the student looked a bit sort of sad at that point, and a bit sort of, and went a bit quiet and went, well, no, not really. I said, well, what did your pastor say? And the student said, well, my pastor was totally dismissive. He literally looked at me and said, it's really easy. It's really easy, son. You choose the Bible or you choose biology. Next question. I said, what did you do? He said, well, I chose biology. I confess that conversation moved me almost to tears. Actually, it still sends me retelling it kind of 7 or 8 years on from when it happened, because although I was thankfully able to try and introduce that guy to some better resources, to useful resources written by Christians and sciences, there had been vast amounts of damage done because his pastor had dismissed the question. It was a perfectly valid question from a young man who was genuinely looking for an answer, and the pastor had just dismissed it, had ridiculed it. He hadn't engaged the young guy in dialogue. He hadn't asked questions back. He hadn't offered any help. And in so doing, he had managed to convince that student that Christianity had no answers. So as we speak with our friends and our neighbors and our colleagues, it is crucial, if they have questions or objections to our faith, that we do our best to address them. So in a minute, I'm going to show you five steps. I promise you five steps that you can go through when engaging a question. Before then, just very briefly, some principles to bear in mind when we're engaging people who have an actual, you know, question about our faith. So the first principle I would say right at the start, remember we want to answer the questioner and not the question. You know, behind every person is a question with a story, a bit like my friend at the University of Toronto, whose story I just told you. There was a story there, and I want to answer the person with that story, not just a random question. And so it's very important, especially, by the way, if we're asked a question we know the answer to, but we don't leap in and go, oh yeah, I know this one, but we don't slow down and figure out, why is this person asking this question right now? There's often a story behind every question. So make sure we answer the questioner, not the question. Second, clarify a question. The what do you mean by that question? And the why do you think that question that we learned in the first session together this afternoon? They are really good for just digging a little bit more deeply into the question. Even saying to your friends, hey, that's a really interesting question. Tell me, why do you ask it? Can sometimes be very, very helpful. I remember teaching a version of this material some years ago to a youth group at a church where I was speaking one evening. And I got a fascinating email a couple of days later from the youth pastor in the church who told me this story. He's in one of the students, 15-year-old kid, had been in my class that evening. 2 days later, this student was in school. He was in a science lesson. He was in the science laboratory. And one of his classmates had looked at him and had said, oh, why are you as a Christian in a science lab? You Christians don't believe in science. What are you doing here? And this youth pastor said, he said, I was so encouraged. But he said, this student who'd been in my class looked at his friend and said, that's a really interesting observation or an interesting idea. Tell me, why do you think that? And it turned out that question opened up this whole conversation where it turned out that his fellow student was not interested in questions about God and science, but his fellow student had just lost a close loved one in a traffic accident a couple of weeks before and was furious at God and furious at anyone associated with God. And this was a question actually about suffering, not a question about science. And because this student had remembered to ask that question, he got to the real issue, and actually it started a friendship where they were able to talk about some things more seriously. So clarify a question. And then thirdly, by the way, if you really have no idea on something you've been asked about, don't be afraid to admit your limitations. We can do huge damage in evangelism if someone asks us about a question and we kind of wade in knowing absolutely nothing, utterly cluelessly, and just cause confusion. I gave you the example when I answered the previous question at the end of the last session. Someone asked about Hinduism, and I utterly raise my hand when I get asked about Hinduism and go, I do not know Hinduism. Islam, yes, I've studied Islam for 25 years. I have a PhD in Quranic studies. I am very confident. Is atheism? Yep, fine. I'm a philosopher. I've taught philosophy, written books on atheism, all those kind of worldviews. But if someone's got a question about Hinduism, I have learned it is much better for me to go, let me hear your question and perhaps clarify and make sure I'm clear. And then what I'll do, I'll then talk to my friend Raheel, who I mentioned to you, who is brilliant, and I'll get an answer to your question, or I'll put you in touch with him when he can answer your question. And it's been a real privilege over the years to just be able to say, I don't know, and to connect people to those who do. Because otherwise you can do damage if you try and muddle through when you don't know an answer. So don't be ashamed. It's not, there's no harm in saying, I literally don't know where to start with that question, but I know someone who does, ideally, or I'll find someone who does. So those things aside, what are these five steps? I told you, I promised you five steps this afternoon. And I was brought up in a Baptist family, Baptist church, and Baptists, we do like five-point things, and particularly acronyms we like. So I've got five steps for you this afternoon for answering tough questions, and each one starts with a different letter of the English word share. So it's nice and easy to remember. And of course, if you grab the slides from that link in the chat, you will have this anyway to take away and remember. But the five steps, I'm going to walk you through the five steps very quickly, but then it could easily be theoretical. So what we're then going to do is take a real example of a real question somebody might ask, very common question, and we'll explore how we would use the five steps to help us just have a conversation with somebody. And remembering this, by the way, we're not thinking about downloading stuff onto people. We're thinking about a conversation in which we might weave some ideas. And the share five steps are designed to help you do that. So what are they, very briefly? So the S of share is for sympathize. When someone asks a tough question or has an objection to the gospel or an issue, I think it's great to begin by affirming the questioner. Someone asks a question, you know, say, that's a really good question. Or you might say, gee, that's a question I used to ask in the past. I can remember asking myself that question, or anything that builds a connection with you and the person you're talking to. So there's now a relationship. It is not, you know, master student or you showing off all the stuff that you know, or you panicking. It's you building a relationship. So S is for sympathize. H is for hidden assumptions. Just like an iceberg, you know, when an iceberg comes along, oceanographers will tell you that the bit of the iceberg that sits above the water is a tiny bit, underneath the water is a much bigger bit. And questions are often the same. There are hidden assumptions. There are things that have got a lot come along with the question that the questioner probably hasn't actually thought about. And a really good first step is to bring some of those to the surface and go, yeah, have you thought about this? Or I wonder if you've noticed this. And we'll see in a minute with the example I'm going to give you how this works. So H is for hidden assumptions. A is for apply the Bible. As we address our friend's question, we want to really begin helping them think about the question they've asked from the perspective of the gospel. You know, a question that may look quite daunting initially can perhaps look less daunting when you walk to the foot of the cross and look at it from there. So you want to gently bring the Bible and the Christian worldview into the conversation you're having. Fourthly, you want to retell the gospel story. This is a crucial one, especially for any of you who are keen on apologetics. It can be very easy, especially if you know the answer to what your friend has asked. That they ask a question, you leap straight in, you give a very clever theological or even a philosophical answer, and then you forget to mention Jesus. We want to point people to Jesus, not just give clever answers to their questions. In fact, I would go so far as saying that any apologetic that doesn't either begin or end at Jesus and the cross doesn't deserve the title Christian. It's just philosophy showing off. So how can we retell part of the gospel story as we engage our friend? And then finally, fifthly, E is for equip your friend. In a short conversation, you probably can't cover everything. You can just scratch the surface and cover a few things. But if the conversation has gone well, your friend is beginning to think about some things, wants to go deeper, how can you equip them? Can you point them to a book? Give them a book. Can you point them to a video, a resource or a website or something that they can then take away and explore themselves too? So I'm a great believer in how do we equip people to go further on themselves when we're not there to continue the conversation. So those are the five steps that I use when I'm faced with a tough question from a friend, a colleague, a neighbor. I don't always follow them in that order. I don't always use all of them. This is not legalism. This is a framework to help us. But I will always have these steps in my mind as I go. And now let me show you how it works with a real live question. And let's take one of the most common questions that people ask about faith. And that's the question of pain and suffering. You know, we live in a messed up, crazy, broken world, whether it's personal injury and pain, suffering, loss, bereavement, or it's the bigger picture of our world right now with, war on the borders of Europe and the Middle East crisis and all the other rubbish that's going on. You know, I often get people ask me versions of if there's a God, how does that make sense? How can you say there's a God when there's all this rubbish in the world? So common question, I think surveys have shown it's one of those five common questions that people have about faith. How might we use the share approach to help us? Well, let's think about that. And as we go, I want to be very clear again, we're not being legalistic. You might not follow things in this order. And by the way, we would do this in conversation. I'm going to share some ideas, but I wouldn't want you to with a friend just say, okay, sit there for a minute while I tell you 4 minutes of content. So remember, I'm just sort of giving you an overview here, but I would do this in a conversation with a friend across the coffee table or whatever. So anyway, off we go. Step one, sympathize. Whenever somebody brings up this issue, I think it's really crucial to sympathize with them, to build a connection, especially by the way, if it's personal suffering. You know, I was, if someone said to me, how can I believe in a good God when my mother's just died of cancer or something? It is crucial that you slow down, that you thank them for their honesty, you reflect with them, God, that must be a terrible experience. I can imagine how it must have made you feel. If you have personally experienced suffering and loss, you know, that can be helpful to bring in to say, I appreciate this question. You know, if cancer is mentioned, I'll often say to people, I've lost 4 really good friends to cancer in the last 6 years, all of whom were under 50. So my word, I feel the bite in this question. So what you want the person to hear is that you understand, you recognize the force of it. So S is sympathize. But then we come to hidden assumptions, and here's where things get interesting. Because I'm looking for an opportunity to weave into the conversation the reality that it's not just Christians who have to wrestle with this question. You see, if you don't believe in God, there is a problem here too. You see, if you don't believe in God, a problem you have is, why is it that evil, injustice, suffering, death, why do those things feel so wrong? After all, if human beings are nothing more than a very clever ape, nothing more than the result of time, chance, natural selection, nothing more than chemicals and atoms, you know, in motion, why does it matter what happens to them? That's a, you know, it's a question that you have to wrestle with if you're an atheist. Why does these things seem so wrong? Furthermore, if someone's died, it is a bereavement that someone's wrestling with. You know, where have we got this idea from that suffering and death aren't right, that they shouldn't be? And of course, once you start throwing around words like good and evil, what do people mean by those words? Aren't those words just personal preferences? You know, you may look at what Vladimir Putin has done in Ukraine and go, that's evil. But Vladimir Putin sits there and goes, well, from my perspective, it's good, actually. And on atheism, who gets this side? And so I want to find a way to suggest to my friends, look, absolutely, Christians have some thinking to do here. But it's not just us who have some thinking to do. And I do think that Christianity has better answers. I can't answer every question. I can't dot every I, cross every T, give you 100% certainty, I said to my friend. But I do think on evil and suffering, I think Christianity has at least some deeper answers than atheism. And by the way, you know, an atheist here to make this observation for us, C.S. Lewis, who was an atheist for the first 30 years of his life, later as a Christian, reflected. He said, back when I was an atheist, he said, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he first has some idea of a straight line. So that's hidden assumptions. Moving on to apply the Bible. I'm looking for an opportunity of the conversation to say to my friend, to bring into the conversation that, look, one of the things that I deeply appreciate about Christianity and I deeply value about the Bible is that it is refreshingly honest about evil and suffering. The Bible doesn't say, hey, the world is all roses and rainbows and kittens. It's all wonderful, nothing to see, move along. But the Bible is very honest on its very first pages that something has gone wrong in God's good creation. The world is not the way it's supposed to be. That something got fundamentally broken when human beings tried to throw God out of the picture and make ourselves the center of the story. But the other thing I say to my friends that I am so deeply appreciative of the Bible is it's also very clear that pain and suffering and evil and death are not the last word. The challenge you have in dealing with this question, if you're an atheist, is evil and suffering are the last word. But the Bible tells a bigger story, it tells the story of what's gone wrong, but it also tells, of course, doesn't it, the bigger story of God's plan to renew and restore his creation and destroy evil once and for all. And I will try and find the opportunity to say to my friends, you know, I wonder whether the reason why we all why all human beings react instinctively with horror at the idea of suffering, death, or injustice is that when we do that, we are revealing that deep down in the very deepest fiber of our being, we know that the Bible's take on evil and suffering is true. The moment as an atheist, you say, that shouldn't be the case. That is not right. You are actually reflecting the biblical story. Well, now we come to retell the biblical gospel story. And one of the things I like about the suffering question, yes, it's hard and it can be quite emotional sometimes. The person you're dealing with has really experienced loss and suffering, is that actually it does link to the cross and the gospel so powerfully. And I'm always looking for an opportunity to say to a friend, look, I think when it comes to evil and suffering and loss, what most of us want done when it comes to evil and suffering is not words spoken, but we want something done about the problem. We want something not said about suffering and injustice and evil. We want something done. And that, by the way, is why we value people who are compassionate. When we see people demonstrate compassion when there's a war zone or suffering or something, we admire compassion. It's a virtue we aspire to. And I quite deliberately want to get the word compassion in there. That's a move I like to do if I can get there. Because the word compassion is a very interesting word. The English word compassion, I'm not au fait with every European language, so this may not work entirely in your language. You may have to contextualize this. Well, the English word compassion consists of two Latin words, com, meaning with, and passion, meaning suffer. And the word compassion literally means to suffer alongside. It means to do something about the injustice and to do something that costs you personally. A good example might be if you're walking along the street and you look across the street and you see a victim getting beaten up by some bullies, by some thugs. You see someone being racially abused and beaten up. And if you just shout out, hey, racism is wrong, and you carry on walking and you do nothing else, you have not been compassionate. You've preached, you made a point, but you haven't done anything. You'll be of no use at all to the victim. On the other hand, if you look across the street and you see someone being beaten up and racially abused by three other people, and you run across the street and you say, hey, racism is wrong, and you wade in and you pull the bullies off the victim, you're taking a risk. You may well get beaten up yourself. There's going to be cost to this. But now you've been compassionate because you've done something and you've stepped in, and it has cost you personally. It's cost you safety. It's cost you all manner of things, potentially. Compassion means actually stepping in such a way that there's a price. And of course, at the heart of the Christian faith, you can no doubt see where I'm going with this. This gives me a bridge to my friends to go, look, the reason I'm a Christian is because I have a faith and a trust in a God who hasn't said something about suffering. God could have sat up there in heaven and just said, hey, suffering is wrong, evil is wrong, injustice is wrong, sort it out. And he did nothing else. Well, he would not be a compassionate God. But he does more than that. Because the God of the Bible, the God of the Christian faith, the God who steps into history in the person of Jesus, who goes to the cross, a God who has done something about evil and suffering and injustice, defeating it and disarming it at Calvary at huge price. But in Jesus, we see a God of compassion, a God who not merely gives us the ability to name evil for what it is, but a God who in Jesus has given us the hope, the confidence, the certainty that one day evil will be gone forever. I always say to my friends, that doesn't take away every question. I still have questions, but I also have confidence despite the questions, because of the kind of God we're talking about. So that was a retold the gospel story. Lastly, before we wrap up this session and have time for some questions, we come to E to equip your friends. And you know, on this question of suffering, there is always more that can be said. This is a massive question, and it's an area where I have found it helpful over the years to be aware of good resources. Particularly, I would always advise, keep your eye out, particularly for books written by Christians who have gone through suffering personally. Those kind of stories are very, very powerful, not just talking theoretically about suffering, but who have lived through suffering and who can talk of the goodness of God in the light of it. Two examples I've got for you this afternoon. You may immediately think of others. There's a book called Why, written by my friend Sharon Dierks. Sharon has spoken at the European Leadership Forum over the years. That book is really powerful because she, her husband's had a long-term medical condition, quite debilitating medical condition. And so that book has a lot of those stories of how she and her family have worked through that and lived with that over the years. Very, very powerful personal story. And she's also a first-class thinker as well. So it brings the personal and the intellectual together. And then the other one that to me is a very moving, very powerful book, Beyond the Big Sea, Hope in the Face of Cancer. Of death, written by a friend of mine called Jeremy Marshall. Jeremy died early this year from cancer. He had cancer for some years. I think he was given 3 years to live, about 6 years, 3 months to live, 6 months, 6 years ago, lived for 5 years. And he had this incredible ministry sharing Christ with those he met on the cancer wards when he was in hospital being treated for his cancer. He would share Christ with the doctors, the nurses, the other patients. And that book, Beyond the Big Sea, is just the most joyful book written by somebody who, boy, does he know what suffering is like, but the joy and the Jesus that flows out of it. A wonderful book to read and to give away to others. So with practice, I've shown you an example there. You can use the share process on questions all over the place. Actually, you can use it on any question about your faith. And as I say, just remember in all of that, that framework's there to help you have a conversation, not to deliver a lecture. And what I have put for you on the notes on the Solas website, and again, the link is in the chat. I'll put it in again at the end, and it's there on that slide. Already up there, there are the slides from this talk, but also my full lecture notes from this third talk. And in there, you'll see another worked example. I've taken the question of violence in the Old Testament, which is a stumbling block for many. And again, showing you how you might use a share approach. And if you want even more examples, grab a copy of my book, How to Talk About Jesus Without Looking Like an Idiot. It's in paperback, audible, and ebook. And there are multiple examples in the chapter there on these five steps.